This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hi, I'm Mary C. Curtis, and this is Equal Time. If it's an election year, expect crime to be an issue. This year, 2024, is no exception. On the local, state, and federal level, the political point scoring has already started, if it ever really ended. Candidates and parties draw conclusions with every headline and exchange rhetoric that shed more heat than light. But the history and reality of America's criminal justice system is more complicated than a tough on crime slogan would indicate. The just published Excessive Punishment, How the Justice System Creates Mass Incarceration, offers essays by about 40 experts on criminal justice, as well as scholars, advocates, people who have experienced incarceration, and former law enforcement. They make the case that public safety, justice, and fairness are not only compatible as goals, but they can and must be achieved together. Lauren Brooke Eisen, the book's editor, is the senior director of the Brennan Center's Justice Program, where she leads the organization's work to reduce America's reliance on incarceration. She's the author of Inside Private Prisons and a former prosecutor. And she joins Equal Time to talk about why the book is especially timely in the present political climate. Welcome, Lauren Brooke Eisen, to Equal Time. And I'll be calling you LB per your request from now on.
Thank you. I'm so thrilled to join you in today's conversation.
So it's interesting, the timing of this book that's just being published. It seems to go against the current tough on crime rhetoric when headlines are focusing on high-profile incidents, particularly in big cities, to score political points. So tell me, why is Excessive Punishment, How the Justice System Creates Mass Incarceration, especially necessary now?
So it's important that the broader public understands that you don't need to sacrifice public safety to have a fair and humane criminal legal system. And the two go hand in hand. And that's what this book highlights, that crime rises and falls. And that is the history of crime and punishment in the United States. Violent crime reached its peak in 1991. But for some blips here and there, we are so much safer than we were in the 1980s and very early 1990s. Yet, when crime does rise, policymakers, decision makers always tend to focus on knee-jerk reactions to crime, such as over-policing and over-incarceration and over-arresting people, instead of focusing on ways to prioritize crime prevention and ways to reduce crime that don't contribute to needless incarceration and needless harm to our communities.
It is a wedge issue, though. Crime becomes, it's emotional because everyone wants safe communities, and it's only human to want to punish people who have wronged others and society. But I wanted to ask you, does that approach work?
You know, the grand irony is that America's experiment with mass incarceration doesn't produce public safety. In fact, the Brennan Center published a report a few years ago where we looked at people in state and federal prison, and we looked at recidivism data. We looked at a lot of research in making our decisions, and we found that almost 40% of people at the time in state and federal prison didn't need to be there when it comes to public safety. That a significant number of those people were in prison for far too long. And some of those people could have avoided imprisonment if judges and prosecutors had agreed to diversion and alternatives to incarceration. There's decades of research indicating that sending people to prison for very lengthy periods of time does not work. And it's exorbitantly expensive. We spend over $180 billion per year on our criminal justice system. And we all care about public safety. We all care about creating safe communities. There are many ways to prevent crime and create safety in America other than over-relying on the draconian measures of incarceration.
So all of these efforts that we see, particularly in some big cities, to recall officials as punishment for being insufficiently tough, you're saying that doesn't work. So what does work?
What does work is crime prevention. So removing guns from our streets, increasing mental health and drug treatment services in our communities, investing in more education, better after school programs. We need to invest dollars into communities we've never invested in. And we have to prioritize affordable housing, schools, hospitals to truly target underlying factors in our communities that might drive people towards the criminal justice system. And this promotes safety from the start rather than asking police to address problems after they've happened. We also need to invest in community anti-violence organizations such as Violence Interrupters and other community-led interventions. And at the back end, we have to fund better reentry programs for people released from prison and provide them with housing and jobs. And there's a great essay in this book on collateral consequences. And it explains that in America, there are more than 40,000 collateral consequences for people with a criminal conviction. And what that means is that people who have a conviction often can't find public housing. They can't get jobs. They can't vote. And that's how we treat people in the United States. And that's truly the theme of this book, is that punishment in America is completely disproportionate to harm that occurs. We've lost any real commitment to proportionality when we erect more and more barriers to reentry, such as restrictions on public housing, job eligibility for those convicted of crimes. And these essays ask whether, when, how we could have made different decisions that would have redirected the evolution of these systems of punishment and how we deal with crime and harm.
Yeah, we saw in Florida, even after voters overwhelmingly wanted former felons to vote, that there were barriers placed in the way. And what's a better way for helping someone feel that they're a member of society than to have that person be able to vote?
Absolutely. And we're an outlier compared to other democratic countries when it comes to collateral consequences of one's conviction. In America, the punishment is not just your sentence. In America, the punishment includes how one might be treated in prison, you know, specifically inhumane treatment, assaults, double bunking, triple bunking in rooms, having bathrooms that are open to anyone who walks by. When people are released from prison, they're restricted from jobs and housing and being able to vote. Many people leave prison with not just lengthy sentences on parole. You know, they have to continue serving some of their sentence on probation or parole in the community. But people are leaving prison with criminal justice debt, and they sometimes can't get off of parole or probation because of this debt. So our nation's system of justice really fails to live up to the American ideals of equality and fairness and redemption. We're sentencing people to a lifetime of punishment, and that's what I think comes out with these essays.
You have a high-powered list of great experts in this book. So they have a lot of great ideas on how to better respond to violent crime than how America does with its excessive punitive sentences. Would you like to highlight some of the experts that you have in your book? I know we don't have time to go through all of them, but if you have a few you would like to highlight.
Absolutely. So there are seeds of hope in this book, and the book does include essays describing new approaches to how some states are reimagining one's experience behind bars so that they're treated with more human dignity and provided more opportunities for job skills and jobs once people are released from prison. There's some wonderful essays, but in terms of the essays that really speak to hope, there's a beautiful essay in this book written by my colleague Ram Subramanian, who writes about the humanizing aspects of some Northern European prisons and the work currently being piloted in the United States. And he makes the point that treating people with respect and dignity is free. It doesn't cost money. And that's not the approach in the United States. So he highlights the great work of an organization called Amend that is working to change culture in America's prisons. And he highlights some of the work of restoring promise to change culture in American prisons. There's a wonderful essay in the book by Professor David Singleton, who writes about the work he conducts to creatively work with prosecutors and judges to create pathways of release from prison. And Allison Siegler, who is a professor at the University of Chicago, a law school, writes about federal legislation that, if passed, could reduce mandatory minimum sentences. So there are essays that focus on hope and seeds of hope in the United States. And, you know, one of my favorite essays in the book is The Conclusion, written by Professor Bruce Western at Columbia and Jeremy Travis, who is a senior fellow at the Columbia Justice Lab. And they write, "The long history of punitive excess with its damaging effects on poor people and in Black and brown communities is itself the product of a grave democracy deficit. The laws that have brought about the era of punitive excess were all passed by our elected representatives." And I think that is such an important statement by them. That quote speaks to me because we have elected these officials, and it's really important that voters understand that we can create safe communities without doubling down on the punitive mistakes of our past. So I love that they highlight that there's a democracy deficit in America and that we have to better educate voters on how to prevent crime, how to create safe communities without relying on over-incarceration.
It makes even more sense then that since we depend so much on our elected officials to make these policies, it seems then even more important that the folks who are incarcerated or newly released would be able to vote since they have so much at stake.
So what we're seeing in Florida, with so many people being disenfranchised by not being able to vote, is devastating. And there are many states in this country that don't allow people to vote unless they've paid their fees and fines. Because if they haven't paid their fees and fines, they're technically still on probation or parole. And there's a beautiful essay in this book by Alexis Harris highlighting the negative impact of criminal justice debt on so many people in this country. You know, 70 million people have a criminal record in the United States. You know, America incarcerates more people than any other country on this planet. You know, we haven't really talked about the numbers yet, but we have almost 2 million people behind bars in this country. We have, 3,000 jails in the United States. And incarceration goes beyond the prison walls. Nearly 4 million people right now are on probation and parole, meaning that they are in their communities, many of them back home, but many of them, to your point, can't vote. They can't find public housing. They're still paying fees and fines. You know, incarceration has incredibly devastating effects on people and their families that last decades. lifetimes after they've served their sentences.
I like the point where you brought up the families as well. It's not just the person. They're going back in the communities. They have wives and children, and it affects the whole community.
Absolutely. In the United States, every single year, more than 600,000 people return home from America's prisons. And these people are our neighbors, our families, our friends. And many of these people are completely unprepared to rejoin their communities because they haven't been given programming or vocational services or connected to jobs when they're released. And what awaits people after incarceration is more and more barriers. And when people do attempt to rejoin their families and their communities, you know, they do run up against these more than 40,000 rules, laws, and regulations that make it nearly impossible for them to find jobs, find housing, or vote. Many of these people have fees and fines because of their contact with the justice system. And sometimes it's the family members who are paying this debt, who are taking on a second job, a third job to help pay for this debt. And so mass incarceration is devastating, not just to those people who have a conviction, who go to jail or prison, but to their families.
You also alluded to the fact that it's an issue of fairness, because we can't talk about this history and what's going on in present times without talking about the role race plays. And I'm sure the book deals with that as well.
Absolutely. So many of these essays in the book focus on the racial disparities that have been created in our criminal justice system, the war on drugs. And one of my favorite essays, I know I keep saying that, in the book is an essay written by Nikechi Taifa on race, mass incarceration, and the disastrous war on drugs. Nikechi Taifa is a civil rights lawyer, and she highlights the intense racial disparities in the criminal justice system. And she notes in her essay that a primary driver of the shameful and destructive statistic of almost 2 million people behind bars in the United States is the disproportionate representation and unequal treatment Black people face at each stage of the criminal justice process. And Nikechi writes about from racially discriminatory profiling and wealth-based bail discrimination to non-diverse juries, harshly severe sentencing laws. So in Nikechi Taifa's essay, she highlights the 1984 Comprehensive Crime Control and Safe Streets Act, which is notorious for eliminating parole in the federal system, and the 1986 Anti-Drug Abuse Act, which established mandatory minimum sentencing schemes, including the infamous 100-to-1 quantity ratio between crack cocaine and powder cocaine. And we know that that law was responsible for flooding the federal prison system with people convicted of low-level and nonviolent drug offenses. We've made some progress on reducing the powder cocaine, crack cocaine disparity in this country with the 2010 signing by President Obama of the Fair Sentencing Act and the recent First Step Act, which made that law retroactive, but we have huge racial disparities in our prison populations and our jail populations, and generations of Black and Latino people have been unnecessarily incarcerated. Much of that driver was the war on drugs.
I think it'd be an interesting time to talk a little bit about our history in this country. How did we get here as a country? We've been building up this system since the 1800s.
We have. So crime started to rise in the 1960s and 1970s. And around 1980, U.S. Congress and most state legislatures enacted laws mandating lengthy prison sentences for drug offenses, violent offenses. And in the 90s, Congress and more than half of the states enacted three strikes and you're out laws that mandated minimum sentences of 25 years or longer. And we saw that more people were going to prison who previously would have received alternatives to incarceration or probation. And we saw that a lot of people who were going to prison were receiving very long sentences. And when you look at a prison population, the size of it depends on two factors: how many people go in and how long those people stay. So we as a country started to send more people to incarceration and for much longer periods of time.
That can't help but blow up the prison population. Also, I think a lot of people don't realize that in our system, a lot of folks who are sitting in jails have not even been convicted of a crime. They just can't afford the bail.
That is absolutely true. So most people in county jail are there because they can't pay their bail and they're just waiting for their next court hearing. And most people who are convicted are in prison. There are some people who are in county jails who may have received a conviction of a year or less. But people don't think about that. You know, the purpose of bail is to ensure people return for their next court dates. And when we set bail so high, or we set bail at all and people can't afford it, they're stuck in jail. And again, these are people who have not been convicted of a crime. They are just there because they don't have the money to pay bail. So if you really care about public safety, what you're saying as a policymaker is, well, if you're wealthy, but you're a public safety threat, you can leave jail. But if you're not wealthy and you're not a public safety threat, you know, you have to stay in jail. It just doesn't make any sense.
Yet this also becomes political because, you know, LB, that anytime there's bail reform and someone gets out and commits a crime, a politician is going to pay the price. Would you say that there is some myths behind bail reform? Because most every effort does get a lot of pushback. We see it in New York State and other places.
At the Brennan Center, we have done research on this, and there is no indication that bail reform causes crime to increase. And again, bail's purpose is to ensure that people return to court. When people are going through the court process, they are supposed to be given due process. If someone has not been convicted, the only goal of bail is to ensure that they're going to come back to their court hearings and that they will finish the process. It's not punishment. Something that I think is really important for the broader public to understand is that if two people are charged with the same crime and one is wealthy and the other is not, the person who can afford bail, the wealthier individual, is more likely to await their next court appearance, their trial at home, with little to no accountability until their next court date, their trial date, while the person who can't afford bail will be detained in jail. We know there are devastating consequences to spending any time in jail. People will potentially lose their jobs, their housing, they're putting their family at risk, they can't take their children to school. The ability to pay cash bail really determines where you wait out the process, at home or in jail. And so what happens in this country is that wealthier people are able to go through the court process at home, while people who can't afford bail are stuck in jail. And we know that many of the jails in our country don't have running water, are not places where people are getting any sort of programming, education. Many jails in this country are under investigation for constitutional violations. So what we've done is really set up a two-tiered system of justice in this country.
Yeah, you've talked about the U.S. being an outlier and other countries doing different things, different programs. You talked about the Amend program. Are there other reforms that we can model that we know work?
Absolutely. We know there are incredibly promising ways to reduce crime that are not complicated and not expensive. We know that better streetlights can reduce crime. We know that investing in after-school programs can reduce crime. We know that investing in and replicating programs that reduce violence in communities reduce crime. We know that improving community green spaces, parks, places where people can gather in the community, investing in housing, reduce crime. And we also have seen new partnerships with prosecutors and judges to create pathways of release from prison where traditional legal avenues offer no hope. We've seen partnerships with police and the community so that if someone calls 911 and a police response is not necessary, sometimes a social worker can attend to that emergency. Or we've seen models such as the co-responder model, where police and a social worker or a community member can respond to a crime together. And, that co-responder model has been replicated across the country and has seen some really good success. My colleagues, Hernandez Stroud and Alianara, write about some of the investments in co-responder models that we've seen in this country. And they note that at least 15 of the 50 largest police departments between January 2020 and July 2022 rolled out new co-responder teams. And they note that these models can produce dramatic cost savings in different jurisdictions.
Well, being that we're not going to see the end of crime and punishment as an issue, particularly in an election year, could you shed some light on what the statistics actually show on where we are as a country when it comes to being safe in terms of public safety?
You know, we are much safer than we were in the 1990s. We know that crime started to increase in 2020. The pandemic played a significant role in disrupting our communities, and economic uncertainty spiked. And this uncertainty can be related to crime. We know the pandemic created mental health effects such as isolation, hopelessness, and loss. And really importantly, and something that I think people don't talk about enough, is that the pandemic shut down all sorts of programs and interventions that cities have relied on to confront violence. After-school programs were shut down. Community violence interrupter programs were shut down. And also there seemed to have been an increase in gun availability at the time. But crime has started. Violent crime has continued to decrease since then. Big cities are incredibly safe. And, you know, what happens is that there's always a perception, and there's always been this perception. You know, Gallup poll has asked people about crime since Gallup started polling people a couple of decades ago.
And they always think it's going up, right?
They always think it's going up. Even in years where crime is incredibly low, people think crime is going up. And what I do think is happening right now is that there's a perception that crime is higher than it is because of that spike in 2020. And it always does take some time for the perception to catch up with the reality. And again, we all want safe communities. We all want less violence. We all want our kids to feel safe walking to school. But we have decades of research that prove there are so many ways to reduce crime that don't involve over-arresting and over-incarcerated people.
Yeah, I grew up in an inner city in Baltimore, and I feel everybody wants to feel protected, but sometimes they feel underprotected and over-policed. They don't want the citizens to be treated as perps, you know? So I think that may be sometimes a misconception that, of course, even in inner city, you really want safety.
You know, there's a great essay in the book by Stanford Law Professor David Sklansky, and he writes that there's no evidence indicating that draconian sentences have done much to reduce violence in the United States. He notes they keep people locked up long after the individual represents any significant threat, and they don't appreciably increase deterrence, which depends more on the certainty of punishment than on its severity. We know so much more than we knew in the 1980s and the 1990s about how to reduce violence, about the importance of investing in the communities that we've divested from, that we've never invested in. And the essays in this book, they ask, you know, how do we hold people accountable without passing on the myriad harms we now know are associated with mass incarceration? And how we grapple with these questions will truly determine whether we can carve a path away from punitive excess in our criminal legal system.
Yeah, that takes some nuance. That takes some nuance. It's a lot easier to throw a slogan out there, right?
It is, but we have to continue to provide research and evidence to decision makers, to policymakers, so they understand that more incarceration, longer incarceration, doesn't make us safe. And, you know, something that a lot of people don't really think about is that people age out of crime. So there's no need to incarcerate people for as long as we do. We have more than 200,000 people in this country serving life without parole sentences. Young people ages, you know, 16, 17 are often tried in adult court in this country. And that really goes to the punitiveness of the criminal legal system in the United States.
And you also have contributions from those who are incarcerated.
Yes. So two of the contributors to the book were incarcerated when they wrote their essays. So Rahsaan New York Thomas wrote his essay from inside California's San Quentin prison. And he wrote that correctional officers are trained not to see us as human. It helps them do their jobs. He has a beautiful essay in the book about othering and how when people are incarcerated, they are considered other, less than human. And I really hope that people read his beautiful essay. And Christopher Blackwell, writing from a prison in Washington State, describes the dehumanizing experience of having to strip nude in front of a correctional officer and some of his very inhumane experiences that he has.
It's interesting that so many of the essays return to the idea of how our system does and does not live up to our American ideals. Sort of, the book seems to call people back to say, is this what America is about?
I think you've hit one of the most important themes of the book. And that's what's so devastating about America's system of punishment. And that's why I think it was so important to put these essays together. You know, taken as a whole, Jeremy Travis at the Columbia Justice Lab said at one point, reading these essays together is a multi-count indictment against the criminal legal system. And I think that's a really good summary of these essays, but they also do have seeds of hope. And that's what's most important about these essays, is that we need to shed light on where the machinery of justice has stopped working while also reimagining our system of punishment in the U.S. And I note in the introduction that for decades, a huge swath of policymakers and government officials weaponized fears about public safety. And we all know it's a familiar playbook in the political arena. Crime has been a wedge issue for decades and might probably be a wedge issue for decades to come. But these essays explore how we as a nation can respond to harm, to injury, to crime without perpetuating mass incarceration, without perpetuating the worst excesses of our system of crime and punishment. And again, really, truly, how we grapple with these questions will determine how we carve a path away from punitive excess in our criminal legal system.
That gives a great summary, as well as provide a playbook for how America can move forward with some great ideas in these essays. But I want to ask you, LB, what question have I not asked that I should have? Because you have something that you really want to make sure you say on the topic, and we haven't covered it yet.
Thank you for asking this question. It's such an important one. And the essays in this book really highlight how our country struggles with the deep-rooted impulse to punish people in ways that are far beyond what could be considered proportionate. And it's this commitment to proportionality that we have lost in this country. And it is up to the voters to elect policymakers who understand that our overly punitive responses to harm, to social disorder, must change. And we have decades of research and evidence and a playbook for how to reduce crime through investing in our communities, investing in our healthcare system, investing in education, investing in after-school programs. We know how to reduce crime without perpetuating the significant generational harms of mass incarceration. And the question will be, can we find enough decision makers and policy makers who understands the need to reduce crime, create safe communities without doubling down on the punitive mistakes of the past?
Well, in an election year, you have to keep that hope up. But I think this book is especially timely. So I want to thank you, Lauren Brooke Eisen, for coming on Equal Time. And we will see how this issue plays out and if your hope will be fulfilled.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate you taking the time. And I do hope that people will take the time to read these essays and work with their local decision makers to improve public safety without relying on over-incarceration.
So, what's keeping me up at night? Well, a lot of what we talked about in this episode of Equal Time, that while there might be a two-tiered system of justice, the loudest political voices are explaining it in all the wrong ways. I learned that lesson years ago from personal experience, and I write about it and more in my rollcall.com columns. Check them out. One Equal Time listener probably echoed the thoughts of many when he said he can't stop thinking about the children starving in Gaza and feeling helpless. It's a story we'll all keep following, of course. I look forward to hearing from our Equal Time listeners for your ideas, comments, and suggestions. What's keeping you up? Contact me on Twitter at mcurtisnc3. I want to thank you for listening to Equal Time. Please subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.